A Midweek Lenten Sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on March 28, 2001, in the series Stations on the Way to Freedom, entitled Courage. The texts for the sermon are Hebrews 5, verses 7 through 10, and John 12, verses 20 through 29. Copyright, Grand Valley State University. Please note that the original recording spanned two sides of a cassette tape, so there is some missing material. I will bridge the gap.
Stations on the Way to Freedom. Those landmarks along one's way that on reflection, at least, appear to be the points at which some new breakthrough happened. Some new dimension of freedom was gained. The idea of stations along the way to freedom comes from Bonhoeffer, as I have said each week. In his case, as he reflected from his prison cell, it was the discipline that led him to action that caused him the suffering that would issue in his death, which for him was the ultimate freedom. And I realize that in reflecting on these things, creating my own list, there's a large measure of autobiography there, but I hope it stimulates reflection on your part as well, to think about the stations along your way that have brought you where you are, which I trust is an increasing experience of freedom. Identity. Who am I? My truth. This I really believe. And then compassion. Compassion which enables one to embrace the whole world and the whole human family. Compassion, which is the consequence of some concrete experience in which one's eyes are opened and one sees, in spite of whatever one's tradition might have taught, that the grace of God is as wide as the whole human family. And then, courage. If in my human experience I have come to some sense of who I am, and if that has resulted in a vision, a perspective, a truth, my truth, Then the question remains, will I have the courage to live it? It's a big question. I doubt that any of us fully live our truth. If I see something, if I really believe something, will I have the courage to go on record? Will I have the courage to stand there? It is a big question. I'm reminded again of the pastor retiring who, in the weekend that Marcus Borg was here, said to me, "I've really been here in my head for a long time, not completing what was implied, but I haven't been able to bring it to expression." That's the dilemma of so many pastors, believe me. If I were to characterize the pathos of the pastorate, maybe no more now than ever, I don't know. but it would be having to preach what one doesn't really believe, and believing what one doesn't really preach. And you can see how that would blunt the edge of the soul and sap the vitality from one. But to live in one's truth, to stand in one's truth, to have the courage to be there, always has to be tempered with judgment, because the human situation is always ambiguous, and one has to weigh the consequences of one's truth if one is to bring it to expression, because it takes not only courage, but it involves a cost, a personal cost, and a cost to the established order of things, to the status quo, to well-ordered institutional life. Now, I suppose that as one rolls that around in one's mind, one has to ask oneself, is that which I see, which is new and groundbreaking, is that the consequence of the fact that where I have been, I just can't be there anymore? I just don't believe it. We've probably have all known people who have left where they were and then proceeded in angry fashion to seek to destroy what was. That's a negative kind of reaction. It often comes from people who have been hurt by a closed system and a closed community and a closed institution, generating therefore hurt and anger, and one can get on a destructive roll where one wants to destroy. And that kind of negativity always has unfortunate consequences. A different scenario is if one has seen something bigger, if one has seen something grander, and then brings that to expression. That too takes courage, and that too involves a cost, and it has consequences. But it has a different feel to it. And even so, one has to be cognizant of those consequences. At our Dubas table in this winter season, when not all chairs are filled every week, we have guest appearances on occasion. And to one who was with us recently, one pastor whom I genuinely admire and respect and hold in esteem, it's been a very, very, very significant minister of the Word of God, and bright, articulate, and faithful. And we were talking about these things, and I said to him, you have been one who has seen some things, and you have expressed them gently and carefully, but you have opted to stay within the limits that would keep the institutional relationship intact. And I said, I say that as an affirmation. You have done well. It's also true that the institution that he served has not been significantly changed in proportion to the insights that he's had. What is the right way? You know, we can badmouth Caiaphas, the high priest, during Jesus' day. But if you would go back in John's Gospel, the chapter previous, there's a point at which they're getting very nervous about Jesus' activity. And Caiaphas just says to them, look, you don't understand. We've got to do something about him, or the Romans will come in here and destroy our nation and this holy place. And he goes on to say, it's better that one man dies than that the whole nation be destroyed. Well, if you had been there at the council, how would you have voted? How would you have voted? It's interesting to compare Caiaphas' words about doing away with Jesus in order to preserve the nation with Jesus' Palm Sunday pronouncement that Luke records in his 19th chapter, where Jesus weeps over Jerusalem and says, oh, if you'd only known the things that make for peace, but now they are hid from your eyes, and there is destruction in your future. Interesting, isn't it, you see? But it's not simple. It's complex. Caiaphas. I don't think Caiaphas was necessarily an evil person. He was the high priest. And maybe he had gotten dulled to the spiritual reality of it all. Maybe he had become a lackey of the system. Maybe he was living well off the system. Maybe all of that is true. But on the other hand, his concern for the temple and for the tradition and for the nation, we have no right to think that that wasn't genuine. But Jesus spoke a word that Caiaphas said would undermine the whole situation and bring us destruction. And Jesus said, because you won't heed this word, destruction is inevitable. You see, because if we perpetuate that which is not right in order to preserve and to hold the status quo and to keep the peace, eventually, that'll catch up to one. Nonetheless, hear me. Acting with courage needs to be tempered with judgment, with good judgment. But sometimes the issues are so very clear that it's not even a question. And I think this is the way it was with Jesus, for he had a moral vision. He had a vision of that tradition of the people of God at its best. And the profit that we've gained from all of the more recent research into the historical Jesus shows us that social context, the political, economic, societal factors that were operative. We see Jesus identifying with the poor and the voiceless ones and the marginalized. We see him recognizing the anguish of the people being exploited by imperial power and collaborative in-house establishment. And when he sees that, he addresses it. And if he doesn't address it, he's immoral. For when the issues are that clear, when it is a matter of justice and mercy, when it is clearly a matter of right and wrong, then it is simply wrong to be in a conspiracy of silence and to refuse to speak up in order simply to preserve the peace. And what we see in Jesus was one who not only had learned who he was in his own struggle as those temptation narratives tell us, not only had come to his vision of the kingdom of God, an alternative society, but then had the courage to address his truth to power. And his Jerusalem encounter was all about that, speaking truth to power.
And, of course, it was precisely for that reason that Caiaphas prevailed.
And he preserved that place, that holy place, a nation, for a little while. And they killed Jesus, whose courage was unflinching, who accepted the consequences of his courageous articulation of his truth. The Hebrew passage, it's an interesting passage. Jesus with loud crying and tears. I said Sunday that it was a watershed moment for me when I could say, Jesus, you're really somebody. When I came to see Jesus in all of the wonder of his humanity, Jesus I knew was always supposed to be special and was impressive, and I went through all of the forms and rituals, but it wasn't until I saw him as a man. As long as he was a supernatural being, someone with two natures, kind of God in our midst, well, that never really got to me. I remember in the spring of 1986, I was invited to do a seminar, an all-day seminar at the seminary in Holland on preaching in Lent, and I had just been discovering that human Jesus. And I shared that down there, and it was about the same time they were considering me for that preaching post. And the chairman of the committee was present at my presentations, and he got so angry with me. And he took me aside and he said, what are you trying to do? Are you trying to stretch it as far as you can? Don't you know that next week I have to interview you for that position? And I said to him, well, interview me. Ask me anything you will, and then vote your conscience. And I was quite taken aback. He said, what were you trying to do? I said, I was trying to give preachers a feel for what it is to preach in Lent when Jesus is really human. John's Gospel, I'm always moved by that text. Now is my soul troubled. And what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. Now, this is why I'm here. And that's John's rendition of the Gethsemane experience. Gethsemane, the garden, is not in John. It's in the other gospel writers. But John gives us this portrait of Jesus who is confronted with the fact that some visiting Greeks want to see him, and it's like a trigger. He knows it's the hour. And so you can almost hear him struggling within himself. If a grain of wheat abides alone, it bears no fruit. If it falls into the ground and dies, it bears much fruit. You can almost see what's going on in Jesus. Am I going to have the courage? Can I stand? Will I stay the course? Will I speak my truth? Now is my soul troubled, and the word is my soul is wrung out. That's Jesus. This is no supernatural being sort of going through a charade. This is a man struggling with what he sees, what he knows to be right and true, and having the courage to speak it and being fully cognizant of the consequences of that action. and he stays the course. As the garden scene renders it, take this cup from me if it be possible. Nevertheless, thy will be done. And that's always the burning point. It was in the early 90s when I began to work on a new mission statement for this congregation. And I can remember at the time thinking, I don't want to just write this thing and have everybody say yes. I wrote a couple of background papers, some theological background papers. Why are we where we are? Because of these reasons. Well, it didn't go very well. And I let it go. Even some of the leadership in this congregation, don't tell it outside of this room, who had listened to a lot of preaching for a long time, weren't quite ready to see the implications of what the theological path had taken us. But eventually we got back at it, and then eventually we agreed on the statement that continues to be printed on our liturgy. There's one little phrase in there which I put in there with total clarity and intention. And it was that the grace of God excludes none on the basis of anything, including sexual orientation. And I did that because I knew if the grace of God in its inclusive nature was going to have any bite, if it was going to be more than just one more statement that everybody accepts anyway. Of course, the grace of God includes everybody. I knew I had to be specific and to say it includes those who have been excluded on the basis of sexual orientation, because Martin Luther said you can profess faith in Jesus Christ all across the board. But if you fail to confess Christ where the battle is raging, it is a case of flight and denial. Well, little did we know, huh? A pastoral care weekend here for the ministry to those who were suffering with the HIV virus. A gentleman appears who turns out to be the pastor of a struggling little group of pilgrims of the Metropolitan Community Church who are meeting in the basement of a bar in Muskegon. And when he said, why in the world would you meet in the basement of a bar on Sunday nights? And they said, well, we wrote 12 or 14 churches, and the few that responded to us said no. And so we said, well, why don't you come to our chapel? Remember the story? We brought it to the consistory so that it would be not simply a bleeding heart liberal pastor saying, come on in, but rather that it would be an officially constituted body that would say, come in. And our consistory sat around, and there was a long, long debate. I think it went on 3 or 4 minutes. And one of our young deacons said, well, what would Jesus do? What would Jesus do? And so this little group came in, and they were here for a year, year and a half, and the Muskegon Chronicle wrote a story about them one day, and the fact that they got a story about them in the Chronicle triggered the whole action in the classes of Muskegon, who held us to account for our ministry to homosexuals, which had been to that point simply a matter of hospitality, you might say human decency. And I rehearse that for you because after a few months of back and forth, I was called to stand before the Muskegon classes. And after lunch that day, we had been subjected to 1 hour of haranguing by the promise keepers, who acted as though there were no women in the place, for one thing. And we're pushing that Promise Keeper program, which is fine, but it's not for me. Enough said. And then it was my turn to stand before the classes. And in order to help the classes in their study, we had passed out some books by Mel White, Stranger at the Gate, which is a fine study, his own story, thinking it would be helpful. And I'll never forget it. A young man stood up and held that book and said, "I can't argue with you. I can't debate with you. I want a question, yes or no. I want an answer, yes or no. Do you affirm what's in this book?" And I said, "Yes." And then the questioning went on here and there, and I don't know how they got into all those other things that are wrong with my theology. But eventually this young man stood up once again and he said to me, "Answer me yes or no. Are you saying that Jesus would affirm a complete and total same-sex union?" This was the day of the O.J. Simpson trial, the day that they got the verdict. And so now I'm confronted with a question, and for the second time in one day, the world held its breath. Yes or no? And I knew that was the moment in which I said, "Yes, if they are promise keepers." It's a true story. It's a true story. I was probably a little bit smart alecky, but it's exactly what I believed, and it's what I believe today. Now, my point is this. It's one thing to write a mission statement. It's one thing to open one's doors and arms. But it's another thing, finally, when one is put on the spot and one can see the consequences and the cost. Then it is a question of courage. And when it is a matter of the inclusion of the gospel and of the grace of God, when it is a justice issue, the Church of Jesus Christ has no right to back away from it in order to preserve its peace and hold itself together. And as a matter of fact, the failure of the leadership of the church to lead the church into the 21st century on this issue has resulted in the denominations left and right being torn apart with anger and hostility, acrimony and bitterness. And there will be a cost for that as well. That Christmas Eve, there was a young man who came visiting his family from out of state, who was gay, who came to me and said, "Thank you. Thank you for what you've done." And I said to him, "Don't thank me. I'm no hero. I got pushed into this. I should have been here a long time ago. But I'll tell you this, I'll never back down a step. And it's time for us to continue to move on behalf of the truth, the grace, the inclusion of the gospel of Jesus Christ." Dear friends, there are things on which Christians can differ. There are issues that are not clear. The human situation is always complex and filled with ambiguity. But there are some things that are clear. And when it comes to issues of justice and mercy and love and grace, we have no right to be silent. Then it is that we must be courageous, whatever the cost. And have I mentioned the freedom? My summary of my experience through that which we all went through together, is that I have a freedom. I didn't know I didn't have. Oh, it is so good to be where we are. I read the religious section of the Grand Rapids Press every Saturday. And I wonder how in the world I've been mixed up with this sick business of religion all my life. It is so good to be free of its institutional form, all of its encumbrances. It is so good to be in a community where we can be honest to God and open to all God's children, standing for justice and mercy and peace. Thanks be to God.